B. Wells diaries, Elizar Snow discourses, the Relief Society minutes that were released, the George Buchanan diaries, the Spencer W. Kimball and David O. McKay diaries, all these records that previously historians had to speculate about, and now we had actual access to, which was phenomenal. Also, we've had a robust scholarly discussion of the 20th century that's come out in the last decade. That was really the trailblazing to help us understand what's going on in the 20th century that wasn't as reflected in some previous scholarship. So I tried to make it a focus in this book that a majority of the book takes place after 1890, which is hard for me because up until 4 years ago, I believe Mormon history ended in 1846 when the Saints left. But it shocked me. Maybe it didn't shock you that, hey, there are interesting things that happen after that. And I was taken by the more modern period and the more modern church and became fascinated. And so in convincing myself to take on this project, I decided I was going to focus on three main tensions at the heart of American religious history through which I would understand the broader context in the through the lens of Mormonism. The division, the tensions between church and state, I'm a political historian, especially in political culture, and I think Mormonism offers a great view to understand that. Faith and intellect, where does religious authority lie? That my intellectual historian training comes in there. And then finally, obedience and dissent. How do you define the boundaries of proper religious practice and belief? And those were the central tensions I was going to dig in. So I started the project, and as I was working through the 20th century, a number of key through lines became central to my argument. Because I wanted this book to speak to the present. Not be, you know, misinterpreting the past in order to understand the present, but to understand how we got to this point. So I ended up trying to demonstrate how modern Mormonism in America became socially conservative, politically Republican, yet culturally diverse. And how we got to that road, and especially emphasizing the contingent nature of that development, and highlighting moments where the faith's past might have taken different directions, was quite crucial to me. And then by the end, so I had my central tensions I started with, the through lines that came to my focus. By the end, I had my thesis. It's probably not a great thing to not discover your thesis until the end, but it happened until me. And I recognized that my thesis was framed by our current experience. And I don't think that's something that we should shy away from, because we want histories to be able to make sense of the present. And the thesis was that modern Mormonism is a product of 200 years of cultural wars. Mm-hmm. Societal conflicts that took place both within the faith and outside the faith, but still structured the faith. This was not a shock to me. This shouldn't have been a shock to me, because I attended BYU during some years when Dick Cheney came to give the commencement address, and Proposition 8 was taking place in California, both of which prompted protests among my fellow students and professors that kind of shocked me, where I'm like, hey, these are people who are faithful and committed, who are, you know, pushing for change and, you know, for civic disobedience or however you want to define it. And it then made sense that if this can't be a new thing, we have to have seeds of that in the past. So I tried to emphasize how there have always been conflicting versions of Mormonism since the very beginning, and how those conflicts shed light on not only the development of the faith, but the development of the nation. And so I had two primary audiences in mind with this, kind of my 1A and 1B audience. My 1A audience are those who may not know much about Mormon history or Mormonism in general, and may be skeptical about the relevance of Mormonism and Mormon history. And I want to convince them that Mormonism is important to understand the broader story of American religious history. My 1B audience is those who are aware of Mormonism, but may not be aware of either the cultural context in which Mormonism evolved, or the dynamic and evolving development of the faith. So I'll give one example of what was a central argument in this. I make as a key push in this book that modern Mormonism was largely created in the 1930s over debates over fundamentalism and modernism and driven by J. Reuben Clark. I place that within the context that was sweeping over America at that time over what were religious fundamentals. So I don't think it's a coincidence then when J. Reuben Clark gives his famous charted course address that fundamentals is the word that shows up more than any other. Right? He's drawing from a cultural playbook. But there's also a contest within Mormonism over fundamentals. This was the same decade that Mormon fundamentalism organizes. This was the same decade that the Third Convention, Indigenista Saints down in Mexico, were seceding over fundamentals of the Book of Mormon. So in a world in which many American religionists were debating about what the religious fundamentals are, you have in Mormonism a fight over what the Mormon fundamentals are. With those saying the fundamental is polygamy, with those in Mexico saying, no, it's the reading of the Lamanites and the Book of Mormon as a chosen race. And in response to all of this, J. Reuben Clark defines what the true Mormon fundamentals are going to be, and it's that cultural matrix, that dictionary of theology, that ends up shaping the modern-day tradition. It shapes ideas of education. It shapes ideas of politics. It shapes ideas of scripture reading. It defines ideas of prophetic authority. And so that's just one example. Now let me talk a little bit about the process of what I tried to do. Maybe in part as a therapy session, so hopefully you can understand where my flaws come. Because there are plenty of flaws that I'm sure many of you can highlight. When I first signed the contract, the project was going to be 140,000 words. Which is, oh, thank you so much. You are a savior. That's great.
Thank you.
Now, I should have realized how preposterous it was to try to cover everything in 140,000 words. My Kingdom of Nauvoo, for anyone who has read that, that was covering 7 years and 120,000 words. And then trying to cover 200 years and 140,000 words. I envisioned 10 chapters, each chapter about 14,000 words. My first drafted chapter, which was going to cover 1890 to 1920, was 30,000 words. And I didn't even cover World War I. It's like at the end of that, I'm like, oh crap, World War I happened during this time. I need to write about it. And I emailed my editor a very frantic email, like 3 in the morning, like, hey, can I get 200,000 words? And he said, no. We ended up compromising, but like, that was really hard. And in the end, I had whole sections that were cut onto the cutting room floor. I had a whole section on Joseph F. Smith's opposition to World War I and the RLDS tradition of pacifism. I had a whole section on young women's diaries and journals and literature during the 1930s. And like, but I came to the realization that I had to stay focused and disciplined on particular through lines, particular characters, and if it did not match that narrative, it could not fit. And so I would pick characters, some characters that would have multi-chapter arcs, like Amy Brown Lyman is one of the major figures that has an arc over several chapters. Some figures that only have an arc in individual subsections. I especially tried to ground the ideas and policies and practices by those who were not from elite circles to understand how things were experienced. So, for instance, I narrate 1850s Utah through the perspective of a woman named Phoebe Woodbury Pendleton. Anyone heard of her before? Yeah. I didn't think so. I hadn't heard of her before until I happened upon a collection of letters that the LDS Church Archives had just purchased a few years ago. She was an adult convert who moves from the East, leaves her adult children behind, and then writes monthly letters to her children telling them what's going on in Utah. And so that adds both flavor and like it helps us understand what the experience in Utah was. And I tried to talk about Phoebe Woodbury just as much as Eliza R. Snow. I also tried to ground each chapter in particular primary sources that I can sprinkle throughout and help give a skeleton to the narrative, to make sure everything is always tethered to an actual experience that is documented at the time. Lucy Mack Smith's memoir, of course, one of the more famous documents, and I use that in the first couple chapters. I use Phoebe Woodbury's letters for 1850s. I use M.Y.B. Wells' diaries and George Buchanan's diaries, both of which were just recently made available and both offer some of the richest perspectives of territorial Utah. Juanita Brooks's letters, B.H. Roberts's writings for mid-20th century, David O. McKay and Leonard Arrington's diaries for the post-World War II era, Carrie Frey and Jen Smith's collection of LGBTQ voices for the modern period. I wanted to make sure that when I talk about things that impacted marginalized figures, whether they be racial minorities or gender minorities, that I don't just talk about the policies, but how their the reactions they got and the impact that they had. All right, so I've probably babbled on quite a bit. I'll only babble on a little more, and then I hope to have quite a bit of discussion. I hope a lot of you have questions, whether about content of the book or the process. But in general, to circle back to Brad's comment that started us, what justifies the new project? I think there's the primary sources have been made available that allow us to take a peek at elements of Mormonism that previously had been secluded. The rise in scholarship, especially on the 20th century, that now we can have a better sense of what 20th century Mormonism was and how it developed. And third, I think it's worth having a book for our time that speaks to our present issues. If you think back to Matt Bowman's amazing book, which, by the way, that he wrote in like 6 weeks, and I still don't understand how that happened. Like, that's just unhuman. That book was published in the midst of the Mormon moment, right? Mitt Romney's presidential campaign, the Book of Mormon on Broadway. It was a moment of triumph for Mormon culture. They finally made it on the main stage, even if they're kind of doofuses on some of those stages, right? But, like, it's a story of Mormon inclusion and assimilation. Writing about Mormonism post-2016 and post-2020 is a different world. Right? We're trying to understand Mormonism in a context where we are in divisive cultural battles that are as deep as they've ever been. And that Mormonism is part of a cultural bloc that is receiving this kind of divisive scholarship in turn. So it might have a bit more of a cynical edge. It might have more of a darker sense. This book ends on a much more sour note than like Matt Bowman's did, because I feel like this moment required it. And this is something that as a historian I struggled with, because sometimes when I'm writing about the 20 teens and 20-aughts, it almost feels like I'm more of a journalist than a historian, because I want that historical distance to make sense of the times. But I also think that if you're not connecting it to the present, it's going to be hard to see those through lines. All right, I am going to read just a couple passages to kind of get a sense of at least the narrative flow. Can I borrow this? Thank you so much. The first one, let's see, I'm going to read one about Walker Lewis and the origins of the racial restriction in territorial Utah. And then I'll read one section on Joseph F. Smith and the vision that came to be known as DNC 138. Both of which emphasizing the cultural context in which they took place and the experiences that led to them. All right, for Walker Lewis, I'm going to read from 102. The background to this is I'm discussing how a series of fears over interracial unions prompts Brigham Young and other white leaders to fear that universal priesthood access and temple access was going to lead to interracial unions, and that with William McCary in winter quarters and Enoch Lewis out in Boston. And I framed this entire discussion around Walker Lewis. For those of you who don't know, Walker Lewis is an African-American convert to Mormonism in 1840s Lowell, at one point becoming basically the branch president of the Lowell congregation. And we know Brigham Young was aware of him because he praised him at one meeting, saying one of our best elders is an African out in Lowell. This follows the discussion that Brigham Young and others outrage over interracial unions. Oblivious to these discussions, Lewis personally informed Wolford Woodruff of his intent to gather to Utah in 1850. The move involved leaving his network of activists, his abolitionist heritage, and even his immediate family. Not knowing what was before him, he prepared a final will and testament, passed all his belongings to his family, and set out for Zion in the spring of 1851 alone. Lewis's time among the Mormons was short. The people were as alien as the environment and the culture as oppressive as the weather. Having left one of the largest hubs of free African Americans, Lewis now found himself in a territory with only around 24 free blacks. More odiously, having previously surrounded himself with anti-slavery activists, he now lived among enslavers. Several of Utah's most prominent men brought their chattel practice from the South, including Charles C. Rich, an apostle from Kentucky who enslaved around a half dozen men and women. Abraham Smoot, a Salt Lake City bishop, enslaved a woman named Lucy. There were around 50 enslaved persons in the territory by 1851. The final nail came when the territorial legislature met during the frigid first months of 1852. Apostle George A. Smith introduced a bill to legalize slavery in Utah Territory. Brigham Young, despite previously expressing moderate anti-slavery sentiments, backed the legislation and delivered a series of sermons that offered the most explicit anti-black theology yet uttered in the Mormon tradition. Young declared himself a firm believer in slavery, though the legislation he supported differentiated Utah's practice from that existing in the South. Those of African descent were naturally designated for service as a seed of Canaan. The very genealogical marker placed on Lewis in his patriarchal blessing was irrevocably cursed. Then I go a few more paragraphs talking about the debate with Orson Pratt. Then I come back to Lewis because I always wanted to ground it in the experience of him. It is unlikely that Lewis heard a rationale for these changes from church leaders. If any of the apostles met with Lewis during his Utah sojourn, none chose to record it. Perhaps they could not bring themselves to face the Mormon elder who no longer had a place in their kingdom. Not Parley Pratt, who had baptized him. Not Wilford Woodruff, who had urged him to gather. And certainly not Brigham Young, who only 5 years earlier had praised him. Lewis, who had dedicated decades to celebrating his African ancestry and fighting for racial equality, discovered his church had formally cursed both. Repulsed, Lewis fled Zion and returned to the East. Not that young-minded. The prophet boasted later that year that the legislature's actions had, quote, nearly freed the territory of the colored population. His sermons and the church's policies had their desired effect of defining their empire's racial boundaries. The saints had found the place that God had prepared, but it was not open for all. Lewis was back near Boston by October 1852, the land of abolitionist agitation, the region where he had worked with David Walker to foment revolution for the cause of emancipation. A local newspaper announced the reopening of his barbershop. Lewis hoped to focus on cutting the hair of little children. Thank you.